back. WNST, Towson, Baltimore, and Baltimore Positive. We've kept it calm, and we've stayed local. And I don't know if this segment here is going to be local, but we're going to localize it. Before we do that, I want to give some love to all of our sponsors here, including our friends at Taharka Ice Cream. We talk so much about them serving up social change made here in Baltimore. We talk to a lot of the folks that make the ice cream, as well as the folks who distribute it. They have become our sponsors. They are truly Baltimore Positive people. And our guest, if we could ship him off some ice cream, we'd ship him this Honey Graham. We hope to have him down here for a crab cake and a ball game at some point. Don also is out in Catonsville with State Fair. I curbsided some chicken and waffles. Don, you've done a little tour. I want you to give a little plug for Evan Brown right now.
Oh, they're doing great things. Matter of fact, I'll be taking the grandkids up there this weekend. A little reward for doing well in their book club. But across the street from State Fair in the Village, they're opening a brand new Mexican restaurant. We'll be opening in the next few months. So great things happening there. And then, of course, we have our friends at Moeller and Gary Realtor, Jeff Moeller, doing amazing work during the pandemic. I don't quite understand it, but he's selling more homes and listing more homes than ever. So give Jeff a call, 410-746-1547. Well, Nestor, I know you have been looking forward to this segment because this is a topic that's near and dear to your heart as someone who lives in the center of the city.
Well, I just want to set the stage for all this because we started Baltimore Positive as sort of a coffee chat and a live thing and bringing people together. Obviously, the pandemic, the last 3 months. And I've been on Don the whole time saying we should have a couple segments a week where we zoom in or call out or find national people who have expertise in something that can really be helpful for Baltimore and foundationally for Baltimore. This guy's been quoted in various stories that we've read and based in places all over about the city. The book is Bleeding Out, The Devastating Consequences of Urban Violence and a Bold New Plan for Peace in the Streets. I do have Police Commissioner Michael Harrison's text on my desk. We've had him on the program as well. Thomas App also comes as a former Obama official and a former professor at Harvard. He is now still up there in Cambridge waiting for the Red Sox to get going, I'm sure. Senior fellow at the Council on Criminal Justice in Cambridge, Massachusetts. We welcome, we can't call him doctor, we're just going to call him Tom Apt. He calls himself Tom, so we're going to say, Tom, welcome on, and congrats on the book and finding your way through all of this, because you have been, as your Twitter handle at Apt_Thomas says, a professional crime nerd. So it is nice to make your acquaintance, Tom. Thanks for coming on with us.
Pleasure to be on the podcast.
Well, Tom, I'm going to jump right in, because what I was struck by, and we're going to let you run with it and hopefully point us in the right direction. I was struck by the fact that you recognize that our cities are ravaged with violence, and there's hardly a big city in America that doesn't deal with the issue of crime, and certainly in Baltimore, we've been unfortunately at the head of the pack with homicide rates and others. And what I'm struck by in your work and in your book, and we're going to give you plenty of time to tell folks where they can get your book, is that you're saying, folks, it does not have to be this way. And you're pretty darn confident about it. So tell us why it doesn't have to be this way.
Sure. I am confident. I am optimistic. As difficult as the challenge of urban violence is, it really doesn't have to be this way. In my book, I detail about 10 to 15 strategies that, if you put them together in the right way, can make transformative change. And by transformative change, I mean reducing homicides by 10% a year for, let's say, 8 years. Now, that might not sound like much, but if you do that, if you cut homicide by 10% each year for 8 years, you've got a greater than 50% reduction. And so what I'm saying is, in the course of two mayoral terms, you can really transform a city in terms of crime and violence. But it has to be done in a very specific, particular way.
Well, let's go through these 15 things here and give me a little bit of Cliff's notes on the book here. All right, so I'm the new mayor, and I call Tom up in Boston and say, all right, come on down, meet with me, Commissioner Harrison here. We've read your book. Where do you start? Where would Sheila Dixon start as the next former mayor of Baltimore in 6 months?
I believe Sheila Dixon, or whoever is ultimately the mayor, needs to begin first with a call to action, and then very quickly to get down to work. And I think the first thing you've got to do is do a really detailed analysis of who's doing the violence, where the violence is happening, and why it's happening. Now, a lot of people will tell you, well, we know all that. We know that it's concentrated in certain neighborhoods.
I bet it's gangs. I bet it's drugs, and right? Literally.
Right. There's a lot of sort of loose talk and easy thinking about these things. But the type of analysis that I'm talking about, which means going over literally every single homicide over the past 2, 3, 4 years, identifying links between various people and places and things, produces a much more detailed understanding. And one of the things that happens when you do this process is that you find out that in Baltimore, and this is true in almost every city around the country, that serious violence is perpetrated by a surprisingly small number of people. So even in Baltimore, where you've got a lot of shootings and a lot of killings, the problem is actually smaller than you think. But you got to do that analysis before you start your work.
So it's smaller than they make it out on the 5 o'clock news. I mean, the number doesn't sound small, right? I mean, every day we're having murder. I mean, 365 days in a year, and especially in a year like this where there is such sort of lawlessness in general going on right now throughout ours, and starting in the White House, that once a day, every day, this is happening here. That doesn't feel small to the news. And it certainly doesn't feel small to the people in our suburbs who told me, and this inspired Baltimore Positive, Tom, which was, I'm not coming back to the city ever again. I don't feel safe. So there's the perception, and then there's the reality of 300 and some odd murders every year here, right?
Tom, pick up on that point from Nestor, because I think that really does cut to the chase, and that is 340 or 350 murders is outrageous, yet you're saying that when you drill down and look at the dots on the map and analyze each one, it's smaller. Tell folks who are driving around the Beltway right now stuck in traffic why those two things can both be true.
Yeah, well, let me use a different word, because I think small suggests that I'm minimizing the problem or suggesting that the problem isn't that important. Public safety and reducing violent crime is the number one challenge in Baltimore. It is choking the lifeblood out of the city. It is the most important public policy challenge. So let me be very clear. It's extremely important. What I meant to say is that the problem is much more concentrated than you think, meaning that while there is a lot of violence, and that violence is extremely serious and it is devastating to the community, the people who are involved in it as perpetrators and as victims are fewer than you might think. And so you don't, and this is something in city after city, it's a very hard point to get across, but it's very important. You don't have to boil the ocean to make big progress in reducing homicide. Meaning, you don't have to cure poverty. You don't have to end structural racism. You don't have to get every single person a job or every single person a GED. I'm a political progressive. I deeply believe in those things, but you don't have to do those things to get some immediate relief from urban violence. To get immediate relief, what you need to do is you need to focus on the concentrated number of people and places, a few hundred people in Baltimore total, a few dozen hotspots in Baltimore total. And then you need to offer those people a series of potential punishments and potential assistance.
Scared straight, essentially. This is an intervention that involves families, the community, to give them the hard consequences. I mean, a tough talk, as they may say, but more than that, right?
Actually, I would really caution against that. Scared Straight is actually one of the most famously ineffective programs in criminal justice.
Okay.
It not only doesn't work, it actually makes people more likely to commit crimes. So it's not Scared Straight. what it is.
Why is that? Because I'm familiar with that as an 8-year-old at Rahway Prison when I was in the late 70s, right? I use that as a term I've been using for 40 years, right?
Yeah, unfortunately, it's sort of one of the... You ever heard of this term of a zombie idea, an idea that just refuses to die? Scared Straight and Dare and Gun Buybacks are some of the sort of famous zombie ideas in crime reduction. Ideas that we keep trying to kill because they are bad ideas and they don't produce the results that we want. Yet people just love the sort of intuitive appeal, and they just can't understand.
Well, it sounds good on the news, right? Literally, it sells a little bit, right?
Sounds great, but it doesn't actually work. And so what I'm suggesting...
Go ahead, Tom. Go back to what you're proposing.
So what I'm suggesting is that you need to give people both carrots and sticks. You have to say, look, the violence must stop. If you are willing to stop what you're doing, we will help you. But if you're not willing to stop, we are going to stop you. And there is a strategy that's famous, that's known to do this. And it's a strategy that's been discussed a lot in the mayoral election. And it's a strategy that's been tried in Baltimore before, but never really effectively implemented. And it's called focused deterrence.
Well, tell us about focused deterrence, because I have done some reading on this. And certainly the Politico piece last week talked a lot about it.
Right. So there was a big article on it the other day, and I'll just, in full disclosure, I have been in Baltimore discussing this strategy. I've tried to help raise money for the strategy in Baltimore. And so it's something that I've looked at carefully in Baltimore. And it's a strategy that basically says, first, form a partnership. Put together police, the community, and service providers. And then... find those highest risk people that I said before, do that analysis, and find those people who are most likely to shoot or be shot, and then this partnership has to speak directly to them. And it has to say, look, you are valuable. If you are willing to stop the violence, we want you back as part of the community, and we will help you become part of the community. But at the same time, there has to be tough love. And it says, look, if you keep shooting, we must separate you from the community, because obviously the safety of the community comes first. And so it's that balanced message. If you just do that tough message, that scared straight message, you're not going to be effective. It's got to be both.
Well, somebody out in the suburbs is saying right now, if we know this guy's a criminal or girl is a criminal, and they shoot people, or they might shoot people, or it sounds like they shoot people, or they're shooting people on talking about shooting people in their text, that the intervention would be to just arrest them and get rid of them. Like, that's what the suburbs would say. It clearly doesn't work that way, right?
Well, but what they don't understand is that there's a difference between what we know and what we can prove beyond a reasonable doubt.
Sure.
So we know that certain people, because of intelligence, because of other various things, are actively involved in gangs and groups and cliques and other things. And we know that they're actively involved in a conflict with another gang or group or clique or whatever. And we know that they're shooting back and forth, and people are telling us that it's this person, that it's that person. But no one will come forward and testify. And so that's what I mean when I say we know who is involved. It is not a secret who's involved in these things. It is not hard to figure out. The challenge is what to do about it. And the point is you can't just arrest them, because you actually don't have a provable case. You might have very good inside information about what happened. But until you have, you know, proof beyond a reasonable doubt, then you need to do this. And the other thing is that if you want to reduce violence significantly, yes, you're going to have to lock some people up, and you should lock some people up. But a lot of people you're going to have to convince to put down the gun voluntarily. So some people who won't listen to reason, they have to be targeted and prosecuted and incarcerated. But a lot of people, we also have to say, look, you can change your life. And if you're willing to change your life, we'll help you. And so
now,
it
Tom,
is.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, that's okay. Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, first question, is this similar or dissimilar, or are there parts that are yes, but not all parts of Safe Streets? Is it similar to a Safe Streets approach?
No, Safe Streets is a different approach using street outreach workers. And, you know, Safe Streets, I believe, has some promise. It has some problems. And so Safe Streets is not going to be a panacea all by itself. You need more than Safe Streets.
Well, you have Roca up in Boston, too, right? We have that in Baltimore, right?
Yep, Roca is a great program.
Well, Tom, it one of the things that folks often ask, and you're as a senior fellow working on criminal justice, is there a subdivision, is there a place in the nation that has tried this and stayed with it, where you can get beyond the theoretical, beyond the models, and say, you're doing it, guys, it works, take a look. Has that happened anywhere?
I would say, in terms of larger cities, I would say the two best examples are probably New York and L.A., two of the largest cities. And the big thing that they have that many cities don't have is they have a large office in the mayor's office with a very senior person who reports directly to the mayor, who is coordinating all of the public safety activities. Remember, public safety and criminal justice is not just about police. It's about prosecutors. It's about corrections. It's about probation. It's about parole. And unless you have someone to bring all of these things together and make sure that they're pulling in the same direction, which many people don't actually know, they often don't pull in the same direction, then you don't get that sustainable progress. And so one of the things that whoever the next mayor of Baltimore is they are going to have to really take aggressive leadership of this problem. They can't just say this is for the police to do. It's not just about the police. The police play a very important role, but it has to be police, the rest of the law enforcement community, and the non-enforcement community. But one of the things that I really see in Baltimore that is lacking is it's not that there's not local talent. It's not that you don't have good programs. Roca is a good program. You have, dozens of really really committed people working on the streets. It's the lack of unified leadership. Unfortunately, this last administration did not provide strong leadership. And so that's what you need.
Thomas Apt is our guest. I want to give a little plug here. Bleeding Out is the book, The Devastating Consequences of Urban Violence and a Bold New Plan for Peace in the Streets. Go ahead, Don.
I was going to say, you obviously have had conversations with different Baltimore City mayors. We've had a mayor went on to be governor, Governor O'Malley. In some of the articles written, I know that you and the governor don't necessarily see eye to eye. The governor is a skeptic. Is it safe to say when it comes to the principles of bleeding out that they will actually work? Is it fair to say that Governor O'Malley is a skeptic?
I don't know. I mean, I don't know if the governor has read my book. I know that, in my book, I talk about how focused deterrence is an effective strategy, and I know that he's a skeptic of that strategy.
That's what I mean, right.
But I also just want to say this. No one strategy, focused deterrence, hotspots policing, ROCA, whatever it is, there's no one strategy that's going to save the city, because in the end, every successful strategy is going to reduce homicides by a little. So one strategy is going to reduce homicides by 5%. Another one will reduce homicides by 8%. Another one, 3%. So you're going to need multiple strategies operating at the same time, and you're going to need someone to coordinate that. And that's why you need a strong mayor who understands it and insists, and this is a real issue in Baltimore, insists that people work well together and coordinate with one another. And one of the things, and it's not just Baltimore, but every city that has a really difficult homicide problem, they also have a lot of difficulty working together. And Baltimore is no exception.
Amen to that. Well, Tom, one of the things that jumps at me is a lot of people are impatient. And, Nestor, for example, is impatient. He's a city resident. Nestor talks from time to time about running for office. Should, if Ernesto Aparicio ends up in City Hall and he's in charge and he calls you and he says, let's go full bore into this. Let's focus deterrence this thing to the best of our ability right now from Jump Street. How quickly would the city of Baltimore begin to see results, Tom?
Well, you know, I would say the first thing we do is we do that analysis and we look at the analysis and then we decide what the strategy is. I am firmly in favor of focused deterrence, but at the end of the day, you got to do your homework. You got to study the issue before you do it. You know, this, as I say in my book, it's like a gunshot wound. You wouldn't treat a gunshot wound without diagnosing it, without seeing where the entry and exit wounds are. So you have to diagnose something, then you treat it, and then you can get to the prognosis. And so I think that that's very important. So what I would say is, if you want to act immediately, let's get this done, analysis done right away. We can have it within a month or 6 weeks. Then let's decide what the right thing to do is. And in terms of really putting together a really coordinated evidence-based strategy, I think that that takes minimum 6 months. And so I think it would be irresponsible for anyone to suggest that, you know, day one, I am going to do something that is going to make an entire, because if you're promising to do something sooner, you're either sacrificing in that you're not doing the study, you're not doing the analysis, or you're rushing implementation. Because I got to tell you, putting these things together, getting the right people in place, getting everyone on the same page, it takes some time. And the fact of the matter is while people always say, you know, we have to deal with this yesterday, Baltimore has been among the top five cities in homicides for decades. And so you actually do have time to analyze this. And really, if you really want to get ahead of this thing, you have to take that pause to change the way you've been doing things, to look at the problem in a new way, and then you can approach it with urgency and intensity. But you can't just go off half-cocked.
Tom Apt is our guest. He's apt_Thomas out on Twitter. He's a professional crime nerd. It says so right here on his Twitter. Senior fellow at the Council on Criminal Justice, and the book is Bleeding Out. You can go check that out. How does a guy become a professional crime nerd? We've done a lot here in the first year just trying to talk to former police chiefs in other places and say, how did that work and where did this work and what happened in Medellin and, you know, all of that, literally all over the world, because I think Baltimore has a world class problem, not just a, you know, we're at the top of class in America. You know, we then move to a whole different category at that point. What makes you so interested in wanting to clean up gangs in my city, Tom?
Well, you know, I think I'm interested in Baltimore because I'm interested in saving lives, and if we can get this problem under control, we can save a lot of lives in Baltimore. In terms of being a crime nerd, I'm like everyone else. I didn't plan this all out. But, you know, since college, I've been working in criminal justice in various forms, various jobs one way or another. And in all these jobs, I had an opportunity to look at the issue of violence and homicide from a new angle. I've looked at it as a prosecutor in New York City. I've looked at it as a political official for President Obama and the Justice Department, and I've looked at it as the head of security for Governor as the head of public safety for Governor Cuomo, managing all of the state public safety agencies. So I've seen it at the local, state, and federal level, and I've seen it up close, and I've seen it from a distance. And so that's really the way that this happened. I sort of. Throughout my career, at every stop in my career, this issue kept coming up. And that's why I felt compelled to write the book.
Well, Tom, I mean, certainly an interesting topic. I am sure that our listeners are jumping on to find the book. Is the book available on Amazon?
It is. It's in bookstores. It's available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble. It's generally available.
Okay, so Burning Out. Folks out there who really care deeply about the city will want to read it, should be part of the discussion. And while we're having a discussion about criminal justice. Can't have you here, and as you said, it's a self-avowed crime nerd. I'm sure you have watched, like so many of us, with so many emotions over the past month when we see a young African-American man jogging through a neighborhood hunted down by white guys in a pickup truck. You then see an African-American who's murdered in the streets of Minneapolis with a police officer putting his knee on his neck, and then which has led now to multiple days of some of the unrest that we really haven't seen since the 60s and 70s on our streets. What are your observations in terms of what do we need to do to stop talking about this issue of a few rogue police officers acting out and endangering African Americans to make real change on the streets of America? Why the heck do we keep having this discussion?
You know, it's a very good question, and it's such a difficult situation. What happened last week in Minneapolis, I've been doing this a long time, and it was shocking even to me. And anyone, whether you're, you know, from the community, from law enforcement, we should all be outraged at actions like that. And it's, I think it's very important that we don't frame this as a community versus the police or protesters versus the police. Police officers, police leaders should be outraged that those officers in Minneapolis did a tremendous disservice to the policing profession, and they will make the profession enormously harder moving forward. So we should really all be on the same side. Now, having said that, what you do about this is very challenging because, you know, we have been, people have been trying, pushing on this for generations and pushing on it very hard, at least since Ferguson in 2014. And we've made some progress, but not enough, clearly not enough. And so what we need is a major commitment, I think, to national policing standards. And unfortunately, that is simply not going to happen under this administration. And so if you want a strong federal leadership on this issue, it's going to have to come from a different administration. And I think we also need to recognize that police and are not a monolith. They're not all the same. And one of the things that I don't think people understand who haven't been doing this work and haven't seen it from the inside is that there's a big difference between police leaders and police unions. And police leaders, chiefs, all around the country, particularly chiefs in large urban places like here, like in Baltimore with Michael Harrison, these police leaders trend much more progressive than you might think. But the unions are a very significant obstacle to change. And I think we need to stop saying, why are the police holding up reform? It's not the police generally, it's police unions. And we have to really focus in. And the next time that collective bargaining agreement is coming up, we have to insist on police accountability measures to make sure that bad officers can be identified early, disciplined early, and if they can't be retrained and if they can't be changed, moved out.
Well, Tom, you are preaching to the choir as a former county executive in Baltimore County with 830,000 some people. I had that discussion more than once with leaders of the FOP. And again, I'm someone who has a great affection for law enforcement officers. I have multiple family members in law enforcement. Obviously, my security detail, anybody who's ever been in one of these elected positions or in one of these, I wasn't elected but appointed when my good friend passed away. But if you've ever served in office and had a security detail, they become part of your family. And my reaction was just what you said, that the police unions across the country really are one of the keys to moving us forward. And they've got to stop this blue wall of silence silliness, because every time they refuse to stand up and speak out against a few rogue actors. I maintain that they put all of their officers at increased risk, and as the word you use, do a disservice, because by and large, well over 90% of the police officers in this nation are doing the right thing every day, trying to do right by their community, but that 10% is endangering them and endangering communities, and the FOP has been on the wrong side of that issue since the beginning.
I think that's right, and I also think we have to really hear what, you know, people are saying, and particularly poor people of color are saying. They're saying that your modest progress, your changes around the margins, your tweaks here and there are just not enough.
Right.
We want significant deep change. And I think they want us to be able to say that killings like what we witnessed last week with George Floyd, the tragic death of George Floyd, will never happen again. And I think we should step up to the plate and answer that call. It will take a big policy change, because right now what we're interested in doing as a criminal justice system is we are trying to minimize the number of deaths, unlawful deaths in police custody. But we're not trying to eliminate them. We're doing our best to keep them to a minimum. And I don't think that we'll ever be able to eliminate sort of split-second decisions where, you know, an officer is chasing someone, the person pulls out a gun or something like that. That will happen. Mistakes will happen. It's terrible, and we can do our best there. But to see an officer in broad daylight slowly squeeze the life out of a non-resisting person in custody, that never has to happen again. It should never happen again. And I think we need to make the policy changes necessary so that we can identify the officer Chauvins early in their career and make sure that they are not putting the community at risk. And we should be intervening before something like this has to happen.
Well, Nestor and I, Tom, are going to be talking shortly. You probably are familiar with this gentleman and some of the proposals. We're going to be talking with the original founder of Black Lives Matter, DeRay McKesson, and he has a new initiative, 8 Can't Wait, where he puts out 8 very, very specific policy proposals that we, you know, in terms of national standards, banning chokeholds, requiring de-escalation, requiring warning before shooting, you know, all these things that when you look down seem to make common sense. And I think you're right. I think what those of us who are trying to listen are hearing from people of color is don't fritter around the edges. Don't try to make small incremental changes. It's time for big systemic changes. And we really appreciate your voice being part of this discussion. And Tom, hope we can circle back with you in the future to sort of be one of our resident experts on criminal justice on Baltimore Positive. And we encourage everybody to go get the book, Bleeding Out. You want to be part of the discussion.
Thank you. I mean, I'm always happy to talk about these issues. And I do have to say, I am familiar with the 8 Can't Wait campaign. I think it makes a lot of sense. What people don't understand about police reform is that internal police reform is more important than external police reform. And what I mean by that is we have to make sure that the police are policing the police. Yes, you can have an outside civilian review board. Yes, you can have independent prosecutors. But at the end of the day, the police have to police their own. And we have to insist that they put the policies in place like this, like these 8 Can't Wait, so that they do that. But this is where the unions will fight hardest. And so people can't take their eye off the ball. I fully support that that movement, but it's not going to be easy.
Isn't it a better insurance policy to self-police and to allocate internal sting reverse sting, things that would sort of put your credibility on the line for officers? That we've seen this in other places, that sort of call the force to some degree to make sure that George Floyd does not happen, that it never happens, that you're always sort of doing some integrity testing of the police, correct?
Well, you know, every police force has an internal affairs and division, and that's extremely important, and that needs to continue to happen. But remember, what's happening here is these are issues that are not really of corruption. They're of police officers who think that they're doing the right thing, or that it's okay to do these things. It's okay to be disrespectful. It's then okay to use excessive force, and then it's ultimately okay to end up killing someone, even though they're not resisting and is in police custody. So I'm not sure that internal affairs would catch these things. What you need is these internal policies regarding use of force that are not about corruption, but are about excessive force. And we have to take these things very seriously. And unfortunately, the union is going to push back on a lot of these things, because they will say, you know, we don't want officers being disciplined when, you know, they're not, they often push back on various forms of discipline. I don't want to get into the weeds here.
Well, we also get a little bit into the weeds, Tom, because I dealt with it repeatedly, and it was very, very, it's not easy. And again, I want to stress that for the 90% or so of police officers out there doing their job, have nothing but admiration and affection. But I will tell you that there are very specific parts of that officer's Bill of Rights that make it very, very difficult to hold police officers accountable. And more than one occasion in Baltimore County, when something would happen that we had concerns about, we'd run headlong into that officer Bill of Rights that was a problem.
I absolutely agree, and that officer Bill of Rights has to change, because it is not serving the vast majority of police officers, as you said, who get up every morning and do the right thing.
Right. It's not serving the community, right? I mean, literally.
And it's not serving the community, of course. And so we've got to have a system that is focused on protecting the community and on respecting officers who are doing the right thing, and not protecting officers who are doing the wrong thing.
What is the Council on Criminal Justice? Because I don't want to get, I mean, we've talked about your book and your background and all that, but I know you made a move recently. You were obviously with the Obama administration, and were at Harvard. Now the Council on Criminal Justice. That sounds like the Halls of Justice.
Well, you know, the Council of, on Criminal Justice is a special organization. If you've heard of the Council on Foreign Relations, it's a similar organization, but for criminal justice. And basically what it does is it creates a membership organization of all of the most elite individuals in the criminal justice system. It's a membership in organization by invitation only. And then the organization tries to find the sensible center on all of the criminal justice issues of today, and tries us to move us forward in a practical way. It's nonpartisan, but it's devoted to the advancement of the criminal justice system so that we can better serve and protect Americans.
I used to say I was nonpartisan, but I gave all that up. We were all partisan at some point. I appreciate you and certainly answering the call and being such a great guest. The Devastating Consequences of Urban Violence and a Bold New Plan for Peace in the Streets. The book is Bleeding Out. He is Thomas App. We call him Tom, and we send you gratitude up to Boston. And at some point, we'll be able to elbow bump, and you come down to Baltimore, get the good crab cakes, and let's fix our city. Okay, pal?
Absolutely. Look forward to being back.
You got it. Don Moeller, former Baltimore County executive, our partner here. And, of course, we're talking about crime. We're talking about race. We're talking about politics. We're talking about the city election, doing all of that out at WNST.net. And loving our sponsors up as well. If you're over in Catonsville, make sure you stop by State Fair. Outdoor social distancing available, which means chicken and waffles are available as well as the shrimp and grits. Opening a Mexican restaurant across the street and in the same parking lot where Fadley's is moving to Catonsville. But right now, Fadley's is serving folks like you downtown. You can even ship Tom Apt and the folks up in Boston crab cakes to go with their clam chowder and all that good stuff. You can do that from Fadley's with one click from Lexington Market. Big shout out to our friends at Moeller & Gary Realty. You can find them out at MoellerAndGary.com. Jeff Moeller, of course, Don's son. You can find him at 410-746-1547 as well. I'm going to get Jeff on a little later on in the month, and we're going to go roundabout at what a summer without baseball looks like around down here. Last but never least, Taharka Ice Cream. I showed the Honey Graham earlier. I'm going to show the Wake and Bake here. Coffee ice cream with a fudge swirl and chunks of fudge brownies. I do not have any Wake and Bake. I mistakenly told our friends at Taharka that I had plenty of it left, and as you can see in the bottom, that there is none left. I'm getting after that that matcha tea and the mint chocolate. Fantastic. I had that last night. Big shout out to Taharka. You can order it. They'll deliver it to you at Taharka.com. Taharka Brothers Ice Cream, made right here in Baltimore. I am Nestor. He is former Baltimore County Executive Don Moeller. Together, we make Baltimore positive. We are WNST.net, AM 1570. Keeping calm, staying local, and always Baltimore positive.